Hey guys, this is Guillaume Joshi with Superior North. Welcome back to my channel. Today we will be talking about Kinder Morgan, which is one of the largest energy infrastructure companies in North America. In this video, we will be talking about Kinder Morgan's business by going over its annual report, then review the company's fundamentals by focusing on its key ratios, and finally find the intrinsic value of the company. So let's dive in and review Kinder Morgan.
Hey guys, let's start off by looking at the Form 10-K, which is the annual report that Kinder Morgan filed with the SEC. This is for the fiscal year that ended December 31st, 2021. On page 7 of this report, the company starts off by talking about its business. Kinder Morgan claims that it is one of the largest energy infrastructure companies in North America. It owns an interest in and operates approximately 83,000 miles of pipeline and 143 terminals. The company's pipelines transport natural gas, renewable fuels, refined petroleum products, crude oil, condensate, CO2, and other products. And its terminals store and handle various commodities including gasoline, diesel fuel, chemicals, biodiesel, renewable fuels, metals, and petroleum coke. On the next page, the company talks about its business strategy. It states that its business strategy is to focus on stable, fee-based energy transportation and storage assets that are central to the energy infrastructure and energy transition of growing markets within North America are served by U.S. exports. Next, the company's strategy is to increase utilization of its existing assets while controlling costs, operating safety, and employing environmentally sound operating practices. After that, the company plans on exercising discipline and capital allocation and in evaluating expansion projects and acquisition opportunities. Additionally, the company plans to leverage economies of scale from acquisition and asset expansion that fit within its strategy. And finally, the company plans to maintain a strong financial profile and enhance and return value to its stockholders. After that, the company describes its four business segments. The first one is its natural gas pipeline segment. The company's natural gas pipeline business segment includes interstate and intrastate pipelines, underground storage facilities, and its LNG liquefaction and terminals facilities, and both FERC-regulated and non-FERC-regulated assets. And the company also has an equity interest in entities that have approximately 27,000 miles of natural gas pipelines, along with associated storage and supply lines for these transportation networks, which are strategically located throughout the North American natural gas pipeline grid. Over the next couple pages, the company talks about the miles of pipelines that it has and the storage capacities associated with this segment. For the natural gas business segment competition, the company states that it competes with interstate and intrastate pipelines for connections to new markets and supplies for transportation, processing, storage, and treatment services. The company's principal elements of competition in various markets are location, rates, terms of services, flexibility, availability of alternative forms of energy, and reliability of service. The second business segment is its products pipeline segment. Kinder Morgan's products pipeline business segment consists of its refined petroleum products, crude oil and condensate pipelines and associated terminals, its southeast terminals, its condensate processing facilities, and its transmix processing facilities. In this table below, the company provides us a list of all the product pipelines that it owns and operates. For this segment competition, the company states that it competes against proprietary pipelines and terminals owned and operated by major oil companies, other independent product pipelines and terminals, and trucking and marine transportation firms. The third business segment is its terminals business segment. Kinder Morgan's terminals business segment includes the operations of its refined petroleum products, chemicals, renewable fuel, and other liquid terminal facilities, and all of its petroleum coke, metals, and ore facilities. In this table below, the company summarizes its terminals business segment assets. For the segment competition, it states that it is one of the largest independent operators of liquid terminals in the United States based on barrels of liquid terminaling capacity. Within this segment, the company competes with other publicly and privately held independent liquid terminals and terminals owned by oil, chemicals, pipeline, and refining companies. The fourth and last business segment is the CO2 segment. Within this segment, the company produces, transports, and markets CO2 for use in enhanced oil recovery projects as a flooding medium for recovering crude oil from mature oil fields. The company also holds ownership interests in several oil-producing fields and owns a crude oil pipeline, all located in the Permian Basin region of West Texas. Over the next couple pages, the company talks about its CO2 resource interest and the CO2 and crude oil pipelines that it has across the country. For the segment competition, Kinder Morgan states that its primary competitors for the sale of CO2 include suppliers that have an ownership interest in McElmo Dome, Bravo Dome, and Sheep Mountain CO2 resources. So those were the company's four business segments. Next, it talks about its major customers. Kinder Morgan states that for each year ended December 31st, 2021, 2020, and 2019, no revenue from transactions with a single external customer accounted for 10% or more of its total consolidated revenues. Additionally, the company does not believe that the loss of revenues from any single customer would have a materially adverse effect on its business, financial position, results of operations, or cash flow. Now let's go to page 124, where the company talks about the revenue that it plans to recognize in the upcoming years. This is the revenue allocated to remaining performance obligations. So right now, these contractual liabilities are sitting on the company's balance sheet. And once the company provides or renders the service that it has obligated to provide, it will be recognizing these numbers and it will flow through the company's revenue and income statement. As we can see, the company has about $28 billion of contracted revenue that it plans to recognize in the upcoming future. Now let's look at the revenue breakdown across the four operating segments. For the fiscal year 2021, the natural gas and pipeline segment brought in about $12 billion. The product pipeline segment brought in about $2 billion. The terminal segment brought in about $1.7 billion. And the CO2 segment brought in about $1 billion. Over the past 3 years, the natural gas pipelines and products pipeline segment has seen a growth in its operating segments. And lastly, the natural gas pipeline segment over the past 3 years has brought in the lion's share of the company's revenue. Next, looking at the operating expenses, the total consolidated operating expenses for the fiscal year 2021 was about $9 billion, out of which the natural gas pipeline segment amounted to about $7 billion. So more than half of the company's total consolidated operating expenses were from the natural gas pipeline segment, which makes sense because majority of the company's revenue comes from the company's natural gas pipeline segment. Now let's quickly go over two of the many risk factors that the company has outlined in its annual report. The first one is that its businesses are dependent on the supply of and demand for the products that it handles. The company outlines that it not only depends in part on continued production of natural gas, crude oil, and other products, but it also depends in part on the level of demand for natural gas, crude oil, natural gas liquids, refined petroleum products, CO2, steel, chemicals, and other products. The company provides us an example where it states that without the addition to crude oil and gas reserves, production will decline over time as reserves are depleted and production costs may rise. Producers may reduce or shut down production during times of lower product prices or higher production costs to extend they become uneconomic. Producers in areas served by Kinder Morgan may not be successful in exploring for and developing additional reserves, and its pipelines and related facilities may not be able to maintain existing volumes of throughput. In other words, the company is saying that in case there is a decrease in the volume of product that it transports, it is going to affect the company's revenues. And the other risk factor that we'll talk about is on page 27, which is about hedging. The company states that its use of hedging arrangements does not eliminate its exposure to commodity price risks and could result in financial losses or volatility in its income. The company then describes that even when they're hedged, these financial losses can occur when production is less than expected, when the counterparty to the hedging contract defaults on their contract obligations, or when there is a change in the expected differential between the underlying price in the hedging agreement and the actual price received. In addition, these hedging arrangements may limit the benefit we would otherwise receive from increase in price for crude oil, natural gas, and natural gas liquids. Furthermore, its hedging arrangements cannot hedge against any decrease in volume of products it handles. In short, the company talks about how it's hedged against any commodity price movements. However, it still has three factors that can lead to financial loss. The company states that by hedging, it is limiting its upside because it cannot capture any increase in profit that would have with the rise in commodity prices. And lastly, the company is unable to hedge against any volume changes, which we talked about in the previous risk factor. Now that we have a brief understanding of the company's business, its four operating segments, its revenue breakdown, and a couple of its risk factors, let's review the company's fundamentals by focusing on its key ratios. Hey guys, now let's look at the key ratios. I'm on Morningstar looking at Kinder Morgan. Under key ratios, we have the financials. The first item on the list is the revenue. The revenue is the top line of the income statement. This is the amount of money that the company brings in via sales. Back in 2012, the company's revenue was about $10 billion. Then it increased to about $16 billion in 2014. After that, for the next couple of years, the company's revenue declined to about $13 billion in 2016. For the next few years, the company's revenue increased to about $14 billion in 2018. It declined to about $12 billion in 2020. And for the most recent year, that is for the fiscal year that ended in 2021, the company's revenue was about $17 billion. So we can clearly see the cyclicality in the company's business, which is inherent with a midstream oil and gas company. Next is the operating income. The operating income is what we get when we subtract the company's cost of goods and operating expenses from the company's revenue. Back in 2012, the company's operating income was about $2.6 billion. And for the year 2021, it had grown to about $4.5 billion. Over the past 10 years, the company's operating income has had a similar trend as the company's revenue. Next is the operating margin. The operating margin is the ratio of the company's operating income to its revenue. In the year 2012, the company's operating margin was about 25.9%. And for the year 2021, that number was about 27.3%. In other words, every $100 that the company made in sales in the year 2021, it had $27.3 left after it paid for the cost of goods and operating expenses. Finally, looking at the net income. The net income is the bottom line of the income statement. This is the amount of money that's left with the company once it pays for the cost of goods, operating expenses, non-operating expenses, interest on its debt obligations, and taxes. Back in 2012, the company's net income was about $315 million. And for the year 2021, it was about $1.8 billion. Over the past 10 years, the company's net income has always been positive, which tells us that the company has always reported a profit. After that, looking at the dividends per share, back in 2012, the company paid out about $1.34 per share as dividend. And for the year 2021, that number was about $1 per share as dividend. Over the past 10 years, the company did cut its dividends in 2016. However, after 2017, the company's dividend payouts have been increasing. Next is the shares outstanding. Back in 2012, the company had 908 million shares outstanding. And for the trailing 12 months, that number had grown to 2,266 million shares outstanding. Over the past 10 years, the company's shares outstanding numbers have been growing, which is fairly common for a midstream oil and gas company, because when a company issues more shares, it's one of the ways for the company to finance its future growth. However, from a shareholder standpoint, when a company issues more shares, it dilutes the existing shareholders' ownership within the company. After that, looking at the book value per share, the book value is what we get when we subtract the company's total liabilities from its total assets. Back in 2012, the company's book value was about $13.39 per share, and for the trailing 12 months, that number was about $13.56 per share. Over the past 10 years, the company's book value per share has always been positive, which tells that the company always had more assets than liabilities on its balance sheet. Finally, looking at the free cash flow. The free cash flow is what we get when we subtract capital spending from the company's operating cash flow. Back in 2012, the company's free cash flow was about $773 million. And for the year 2021, it was $4,427 million. Ideally, we want to see the company's free cash flow to be positive, staying steady, or increasing. In the case of Kinder Morgan, the company's free cash flow has always been positive and has been trending upwards. I will be using the 2021 free cash flow number of $4,427 million from a discounted free cash flow DCF analysis. Now let's look at the profitability of the company, focusing on the net margin. The net margin is the ratio of the company's bottom line to its top line, so it compares the company's net income to its revenue. Back in 2012, the company's net margin was about 3.16%, and for the year 2021, it was 10.66%. What this means is every $100 that the company made in sales in the year 2021, by the time it paid for its cost of goods, operating expenses, non-operating expenses, interest on its debt obligations, and taxes, it had $10.66 left as pure profit. Next is the return on equity. The return on equity compares the company's income to its shareholders' equity. Warren Buffett prefers to only invest in securities that have a return on equity of 8% or greater every year for the past 10 years. Back in 2012, the company's return on equity was about 3.67%. And for the year 2021, it was 5.69%. The three ways a company can increase its return on equity is first by taking on more debt. That is, when a company becomes more leveraged, it can increase its return on equity numbers. Second is when a company buys back its shares. And third is when a company increases its income numbers on its income statement. Next is the return on invested capital. This number gives us an idea of how good the management is at allocating the company's capital and getting a return on that investment. Back in 2012, the company's return on invested capital was about 4.56%, and for the trailing 12 months, that number was about 2.73%. Kinder Morgan's weighted average cost of capital, also known as the company's hurdle rate, is about 4.91%, and since the company's return on invested capital is lower than the company's weighted average cost of capital, we can say that the company's management is not creating value for its shareholders. Finally, looking at the interest coverage, the interest coverage is the ratio of the company's income to its interest obligations. So it gives us an idea of how many times can the company pay off its interest obligations using its income in that calendar year. For some reason, Morningstar does not show us the 2021 interest coverage number, but we can use the company's annual statement to find that number. What we would do is we would divide 6,547 by the company's interest obligation, which is 1,492, and we get about 4.3 times. Benjamin Graham, the father of value investing, preferred to only invest in securities that had an interest coverage of 5 times or higher. Now let's look at the company's financial health and liquidity ratios. The first item on the list is the current ratio. The current ratio compares the company's current assets to its current liabilities. Ideally, we want to see the company's current ratio to be greater than 1.0, as that tells us that the company has enough assets to fulfill its liabilities over the next 12 months. Back in 2012, the company's current ratio was at 0.71, and for the latest quarter, it was at 0.66. Next is the quick ratio. The quick ratio is similar to the current ratio, except we disregard the inventory component. In other words, quick ratio is equal to current assets minus inventory divided by current liabilities. Ideally, we want to see the company's quick ratio to be greater than 1.0, as that tells us that the company does not have to rely on selling its inventory in order to fulfill its current liabilities. Back in 2012, the company's quick ratio was at 0.41, and for the latest quarter, it's at 0.47. Over the past 10 years, the company's current and quick ratios have stayed fairly consistent. Next is the financial leverage. The financial leverage is the ratio of the company's total assets to its shareholders' equity. A high financial leverage tells us that more of the company's assets are financed via liabilities. Back in 2012, the company's financial leverage was at 4.92, and for the latest quarter, it's at 2.28. Ideally, we want the company's financial leverage to be staying steady or decreasing. Kinder Morgan's financial leverage has come down from its peak in 2013 when it was 5.74 times and has stayed fairly consistent over the past few years. Finally, looking at the debt-to-equity ratio, this ratio compares the company's total debt to its shareholders' equity. Ideally, we want the company's debt-to-equity ratio to be less than 1.0. Back in 2012, the company's debt-to-equity ratio was at 2.30, and for the latest quarter, it's at 0.99. The company's debt-to-equity ratio has a similar trend as the company's financial leverage. Now let's look at the company's efficiency ratios. The first item on the list is the day sales outstanding. This number gives an idea of how many days go by from the day the company recognizes its sale to the date actually receives cash for that service rendered. Back in 2012, the company's day sales outstanding was about 42 days, and for the trailing 12 months, that number was about 32 days. Ideally, we want the company's day sales outstanding number to be staying steady or decreasing. What we do not want to see is a company whose day sales outstanding number is growing rapidly, as that tells us that the company's management is being aggressive with its accounting as it's trying to recognize its revenue sooner so that it can inflate its income numbers on its income statement. However, in the case of Kinder Morgan, it appears that the management is not playing any such accounting tricks, as the company's day sales outstanding numbers have always fluctuated between 30 and 40 day range. Next is the day's inventory. This number gives an idea of how many days does the company's product sit in its inventory before it's sold. Back in 2012, the company's day's inventory was about 22 days, and for the trailing 12 months, that number was about 19 days. Ideally, we want the company's day's inventory number to be staying steady or decreasing. What we do not want to see is a company whose day's inventory number is growing, because we never want to see a company whose inventory just lingers around on its balance sheet. We rather see that inventory being pushed onto the company's income statement and realized as profit. Finally, looking at the payables period, this number gives an idea of how many days does the company take to pay its suppliers. Back in 2012, the company took about 79 days to pay its suppliers, and for the trailing 12 months, that number was about 44 days. Ideally, we want the company's payables period to be staying steady or decreasing. What we do not want to see is a company whose payables period is growing rapidly, as that tells us that the company's management is holding on to its cash in order to artificially inflate its cash flow numbers. However, Kinder Morgan's management does not appear to be playing any such accounting tricks. Now let's look at Kinder Morgan's current valuation. The first item on the list is the price-to-earnings ratio. Kinder Morgan has a PE of 21.3. The company's price to book is at 1.2. The company's price to sales is at 2.3. It has a price to cash flow of 6.6 times and has a dividend yield of 6.5%. When we compare Kinder Morgan's current valuation to its 5-year average, we can see that on all the valuation metrics, Kinder Morgan is currently undervalued. Additionally, when we compare Kinder Morgan to the S&P 500, and the S&P 500 is the aggregate of the top 500 companies in the United States, and we can think of the S&P 500 as our opportunity cost. We can see that on all the valuation metrics, the company is undervalued when compared to the S&P 500. Now let's look at Kinder Morgan's discounted free cash flow DCF analysis. Over here, I pasted the company's 2021 free cash flow number that I got from Morningstar, which was $4,427 million. I'm using an annual growth rate of free cash flow to be 6%. What this means is I expect the company's free cash flow to grow at 6% every year for the next 10 years. I'm using a discount rate of 10%. What this means is I want this investment to give me a 10% return. In other words, I want to double my investment in about 7 years. I'm using a long-term growth rate of 2.245%. What this means is after the 10-year mark into perpetuity, I expect the company's free cash flow to grow at 2.245%. This number is in line with the U.S. 30-year Treasury yield. The company has 2,266 million shares outstanding and has a long-term debt of $30,564 million. After taking all of these inputs into account, we get the company's intrinsic value to be about $19.68 per share. And when we compare this intrinsic value to the company's current stock price, which is about $16.6 per share, we can see that the company's current stock is trading about 16% below the company's intrinsic value. The way we calculate this intrinsic value is we look at what the free cash flows would be every year for the next 10 years. We sum up all those free cash flows, which come out to about $36 billion. Then we look at what the free cash flows would be after the 10-year mark into perpetuity. We sum all those up to get the intrinsic value to be about $75 billion. From this number, we subtract the long-term debt and divide by the shares outstanding to get the intrinsic value per share to be about $19.68. If we disregard the perpetuity component, in other words, if you think that Kinder Morgan is only going to grow for the next 10 years and then it'll cease to exist, then we get the intrinsic value without the perpetuity to be about $2.5 per share. If we disregard the debt, in other words, if you think that Kinder Morgan is going to grow into perpetuity, so there's no point for the company to worry about paying off its debt, then we get the intrinsic value without the debt to be about $33 per share. Finally, let's try to figure out what kind of return can we expect to get on this investment if you were to invest in this security at the current stock price. For this, we will run a Goldseek analysis. We'll set our sell to the intrinsic value, and we'll set our value to the current stock price, which is about $16.6 per share. We'll run this analysis by changing our discount rate. And what we get is if you were to invest in the security at the current stock price, we can expect to get about 10.7% return on this investment. Overall, Kinder Morgan has good fundamentals. However, it has low return on equity, low return on invested capital, and subpar interest coverage. Kinder Morgan has 50% market share of pipelines and has no direct exposure to commodity prices. The company should benefit from increased drilling activities in the United States and higher demand of natural gas internationally. Additionally, the company should benefit from the higher throughput brought about with the increased demand of liquefied natural gas. In the most recent quarter, the company's business operations was hurt due to increased competition in its pipeline business in Mexico and lower drilling levels in Colorado. Hey guys, that is all I had for you this week. Hopefully you found this video on Kinder Morgan interesting. If you like this content, please do like, share, comment, and subscribe. And if you have any suggestions on which stock I should review next, please leave it in the comment section below. I'll greatly appreciate it. Thank you.